today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I would always say I knew who Quincy was. It's kind of like your uncle. Like, you grow up and like it was, he was always there.
Very sad news from the world of music this week. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
We got news a few days ago of the death of Quincy Jones at age 91. And to say that Quincy Jones was a giant in music, you know, was obvious and perhaps even an understatement in some ways, right? I mean, it's the first word that comes to mind when you hear the name Quincy Jones. The man had done so much. And we wanted to take some time on this episode to discuss his contributions and pay some tribute. And with us today is my dear friend, Ed Bowser. Hello, Ed.
What up, Jim? How you doing, Patrick? Happy Good. To be in the house again.
Yep. Yeah, happy to have you.
Ed, tell us a little bit about your blog and other work that you do in music.
Man, a ton. So again, I'm Edward Bowser. I am the founder, runner, and Soul in the Stereo boss. Soulinstereo.com is what I've been doing for over a decade now. It's a hub for not just music, but pop culture, specifically hip-hop, R&B, history, album reviews, album rankings of your favorite artists on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. We've got a growing YouTube presence, great Facebook community, and soulandstereo.com was, of course, the hub for all of this.
Amazing, amazing work. It's really incredible, people, so check that out for sure.
You got to check it out, and I want to say a special, a little quick shout-out for those of us in the community who are MF Doom fans, because there's a piece up of ranking Doomsday songs, the MF Doom album, and I really enjoyed that one. That was great. So I know there's a lot of fans of MF Doom out here who probably want to go out and see it.
Yes, I'm a big Doom fan. We just celebrated 25 years of that album. That's my favorite Doom album, and nice. I rank his whole discography too. So lots of stuff there for my Doom fans.
Yep, absolutely.
Very cool. All right. So I really wanted to talk with Ed today because he posted something on Facebook that where you said that Quincy Jones impacted you not just as a music fan, but as a person in some ways.
Absolutely.
Right? So just give us, you know, your sort of your relationship, I guess, with the music or the person who was Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones to me is like, if I could say, the Forrest Gump of R&B, because that man knew everyone, met everyone, and led such a life that's just impossible. So you've been seeing a lot of these Quincy Jones kind of tributes over the past week or so, and it's usually him and Michael. We're talking Off the Wall, and we're talking Thriller, a little bit of Bad. But his legacy, its tentacles just stretch so much further. So as a fan, I would always say I knew who Quincy was. It's kind of like your uncle. Like, you grow up and like it was, he was always there. Like, you knew who Quincy Jones was, even if you didn't know all about him. My biggest introduction to him was in 95, his Q's Juke Joint album. And he did like a lot of stuff with Babyface, introduced Tamia, one of my favorite R&B singers. But from that, not only did I know he was this great producer that put on Michael Jackson, he was still discovering new artists. But things that were so integral to me as a person, as a fan of Black culture, my culture, was things like the creation of Vibe magazine, mm-hmm. which is a huge influence who in just my journalism career, as Jim knows, but also as I spread out and became a music writer, Vibe magazine was like the blueprint for my voice, becoming a writer as an album reviewer, and just journalism in itself. A lot of that was spearheaded by him. My favorite TV shows, he had a hand in that. Cosby Show, Sanford and Son, Fresh Prince, Mad TV, Liz, Color Purple. Like, you can just go forever. There are all these elements of who I was growing up that I didn't realize had his fingerprints on it. And when you just start pulling back the layers to see that Quincy touched everything I loved, everything that made me who I am as a creator, as a writer, as a thinker, really had his stamp on it.
That's amazing. That's amazing. You know, I'll just say that, yes, he's one of these guys who you knew him even though he was not front and center, right? Which is, I think, an achievement in itself. You know, when I say he's a giant in music without being the guy who's the public face, really.
Right.
I mean, as an 80s kid, of course, I knew him first from Off the Wall and Thriller, yeah. Right? And, you know, and the production on those is amazing, right? And you also got this sense, as you started to learn a little bit more about him, that he was the kind of guy who had credibility and then could have some influence on somebody like Michael Jackson, right? Who could speak to him, you know, and Michael would listen. And I think that was probably really important in how those albums were put together. And then, of course, We Are the World. That was the other big thing in the 80s, right? And it's so funny when I watched the Netflix documentary on that. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
Yep.
It's really amazing because you see a man at work. Like, he is the guy just there getting stuff done. And to me, that's more impressive than any kind of like stardom. You know, he's just somebody who understood from decades of experience what it was going to take to make this happen, to corral these people and get the tracks laid that needed to get laid in that amount of time. And, you know, of course, deal with all the egos and all that kind of stuff. Although I think Lionel Richie was probably the big, you know, influence there in terms of that side of it. But you just mm-hmm. saw Quincy Jones, a man just at work, getting the work done. And I thought that was just so impressive because we think of music as, you know, divas and prima donnas and, you know, people who are out partying and having a good time and everything. But it's a lot of work. And I think he understood that. So that's my main take. And then, of course, you know, like I said, being introduced to this man in the 80s from pop music and then learning he had this incredible career before that I didn't even know anything about, that I came to learn later, you know, as a fan, when I just pulled out of my record collection here this Frank Sinatra Count Basie album, and right like in the center of the cover, it says arrangements by Quincy Jones. And you're like, what? What's this all about? You know, and then you learn about this vast, vast career in jazz that's just really, really impressive. So, okay, that's me. So, Patrick, anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Ed was saying, to kind of pick up on that, you know, I think when you look at his body of work, you could, if you wanted to, just take out, let's say, for example, all the stuff he did as a soundtrack arranger and composer, right? That would stand with any soundtrack arranger and composer you could name. You could take out everything he did as a producer, and that would stand with or above anybody who's ever been a producer. And, you know, it goes on to business. It goes on to his own music, where he put bands together and arranged songs, and, you know, had singers come in, and he did, you know, he worked in that jazz style. He worked in a little bit in that sort of bossa nova style as well, which is amazing. And I was reading something, I forget where I saw this, but it was a little anecdote about the record company had wanted to get Quincy to produce an album by Rufus when Chaka Khan was in the band. And the guys in Rufus were like, no, he's going to be too square, man. He's just not, you know, he's too much of an establishment guy. This is not going to work. And then they said the first day they came in and all they did was sit around and just talk, you know, for like 3 hours and just talk about stuff they had in common, people they knew, influences. And by that point, the band was 100% ready, you know, to work with him. He didn't even say anything about the music. He just wanted to get to know the people and tell them where he was coming from. And, you know, for a funky band like Rufus, I can see where they were coming from, maybe thinking he was a little too establishment, but the music they made together, you know, was pretty amazing. I can't think of any other people really in music. There are very few who were able to travel in all those different areas and be right up there with the absolute most talented that have ever done it.
Patrick, you bring up a great point, and I thought of it when Jim was talking about We Are the World. I think Quincy's greatest strength is like this, the great connector, because no matter who he has in the room, he can bring them together, all these different sounds, personalities, and bring something out. And that's one thing that I hear a lot today in music, when people are like, why can't we have a We Are the World today?
Yep.
Because who has that clout that can bring all these artists together, get rid of the egos, focus, and make it not only deal with the personalities, but the music as well, and be that respected? I feel like that's the biggest thing that's really being lost in Quincy's loss here.
That's a great point.
You know, it's so interesting, too, reading the New York Times obituary. That was like the first or second graph talked about his connections, that was his superpower, you know, in some way. And building off of what Patrick was saying about the establishment part, I mean, Quincy Jones was like 50 when Thriller came out, right? So
he was
not a young man at that time. But yet, even after that, he stayed very vital in the music scene, and, you know, got into hip hop. You know, I looked up the first time the Grammys gave out the award for best rap performance by a duo or a group, 1991, went to Quincy Jones' album Back on the Block, which had Big Daddy Kane, Ice-T, Kool Moe Dee, Melly Mel, you know, and so on.
Let me kick my credentials. A young player bred in South Central LA, home of the body bag. You wanna die, wear the wrong color rag. I used to walk in stores and yell, lay down. You flinch an inch, AK spray down. But I was lucky cause I never caught the hard time. I was lucky to skill to bust a dope rhyme. All my homies died, I caught the penzo. Lost the diamonds, cops told the benzos. Living that life that we thought was it. Fast laning, but the car flipped. I'm not gonna lie to you cause I don't lie. I just kick thick game. Some people say, why? Cause I'm back on the block, I got my life back. So I school the fools about the fast track. I get static on my style and my technique. Profanity, the blade way in which I speak. But the dude knows the streets ain't no kiddie game. You don't know the dude? Quincy's his first name. He told me, Ice, keep doing what you're doing, man. Don't give a damn if the squares don't understand. You let them tell you what to say and what to write. Your whole career be over by tomorrow night. Rap from your heart, and your heart's with the street. Rap on my record, man, come equal, send Ice to beat. The dude is deaf in the back, what can I say? The man can roll with Ice to the microchip.
Back. Back on the block. Back. Back on the block. Back on the block. So we can rock with the soul, rhythm, blues.
You know, there's a guy who's, now at that point, you know, he's pushing 60, right? But he's embracing the music of that time, which I think is impressive.
And that's something that is not done. And I talk a lot about the changing face of music, even in the 2010s and social media, and how there was two camps. There was this established legends and there was the new generation, and they were butting heads because nobody wanted to see where the other was coming from. That was not Quincy. Quincy always rolled with the times. He was always bringing in new artists. He was always introducing artists, and he never put them in a box. He was like, okay, this is you. How can we uplift what you're doing? And not just, you're going to sound like Bossa Nova. Like, that never happened. Right. Like, you're going to evolve, and I will help you evolve. And that's why I think he's so respected in hip hop, because when I think on some of the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest hip hop beat of all time, Mobb Deep, Shook Ones, that's a Quincy sample.
Hold up, son, word. Yeah, to all the killers and the $100 billers. For real, because who ain't got no feelings, feelings. Check it out. I
Queensbridge murderers. Tomorrow comes equipped for warfare. Beware of my crime family who got enough shots to share. For all those who wanna profile and pose, rock you in your face, stab your brain with your nose bone. You all alone in these streets, cousin. Every man for theyself in his land. We be gunning and keep them shook crews running like they supposed to. They come around, but they never come close to. I can see it inside your face. You're in the wrong place. Cowards like you just get their whole body laced up with bullet holes and such. Speak the wrong words, man, and you will get touched. You can put your whole army against my teammate. I guarantee you it'll be your very last time breathing. Your simple words just don't move me. You're minor, we major. You're all up in the game and don't deserve to be a player. Don't make me have to call your name out. Your crew is featherweight. My gunshots will make you levitate. I'm only 19, but my mind is older. When the things get for real, my warm heart turns cold. Another nigga deceased, another story is told. It ain't nothing really, and your gun sparked the Philly. So I could get my mind off these yellow back niggas. While they still alive, I don't know, go figure. Meanwhile, back in Queens, the realness and foundation. If I die, I couldn't choose a better location when the slugs penetrate.
There's so much stuff that he has touched, and it's because he has the respect from Far Side, Passing Me By, and De La sampling Michael Jackson. All of that is Quincy. So even when the times change, his fingerprint is still there because he has the respect.
That's a great point. And I don't know, Ed, maybe could you talk a little bit about his impact as a businessman and even as a philanthropist too, because he did start foundations. I remember he had that thing with Bono for a long time where they you know, raised money. But how do you see him inspiring others to be able to say to themselves, I can do this. I can start my own business or my own production company or my own record label.
There was always like a realness to Quincy that made him relatable. And not only in the way he was able, and that's probably why he was able to be this great connector, but because he just stayed so rooted in who he was. So he's like, okay, I'm going to do this business, but I'm doing it to help my community. Right. And even actually he became who he was still doing stuff in Africa and doing stuff for hunger and poverty. And I think that's what helps build this legacy of not just a mogul, which we see today where everyone's like, okay, I just want to be the guy who has a bunch of artists on his label and I'm popping Cristal. But his legacy was, I'm going to get this business started to help others. So that was inspiring to other folks. They was able to help. They were more willing to collaborate because it's like, this is a good guy. And he became the template for philanthropy and success at the same time while also moving his business forward. It was pretty brilliant. I'm not saying that it was some ulterior motive behind it, but he was able to play both fields so well. I think that's why he has that respect now, whereas a lot of our moguls today is just one track mind, get to the top of the charts. That was never Quincy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was even, you know, in my mind, I was doing some comparison, like could maybe Ahmet and Jerry Wexler at Atlantic, you know, be considered. Yeah, they were equal to him in the, you know, finding artists and creating a musical legacy. But all the other stuff he did, they never did any of that stuff.
Not close. Not even close.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, it's so interesting, too, because in the early 60s, he was working at Mercury Records. And he was a VP. He was the first black man to be a VP at a white-owned label. And, you know, he was centered in jazz at that point. But he realized that, you know, the tide was turning. And so he signed, you know, pop artists, right? Including Leslie Gore. He produced Leslie Gore. It's My Party and You Don't Own Me and those songs, right? That's amazing. It's my party and I cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. Cry if I want to. It's my party and I cry if I want to. You would cry too if it happened to you. Nobody knows where my Johnny has gone. But Judy left the same time. Why was he holding her hand when he's supposed to be mine? And apparently there's a story too about how he rushed It's My Party to get it pressed before Phil Spector could do it with the Crystals. Apparently Phil Spector was working on it with the Crystals, and Quincy rushed that through. And of course that became a huge hit for Leslie Gore. But anyway, so he recognized where music and culture were headed, and he wasn't stuck in any one camp where he said, you know, that he wasn't going to embrace it, as we discussed. And part of that could just be the breadth of his music interest, but part of it too could be self-preservation. It could be, you know, business sense, what have you. But then later, when he had his own label in the 80s called Quest, he signed some popular artists, but he also signed some artists who just he liked. He believed in, he liked their music, and he wasn't so concerned about, you know, whether or not they'd be commercially viable or commercial hits, right? So he really, I think, had feet in both sides, you know, the commercial side of the business and the artistic side of the business. Also, New Order was on Quest, which...
Yes, they were. That was crazy. Yeah, that is... I forgot about that, but you're right, they were.
I totally forgot about Quest until you just mentioned it. Yes, that was a blast to my previous past, because when I was growing up, I remember Quest very well. I totally forgot. Quest just did so much stuff. It's hard to just nail everything down to just a few bullet points.
Yep.
Oh, it's crazy. When you talked about Vibe magazine, like the New York Times obit didn't even mention that. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah. And it was such a huge part of who I was. And I don't want to say I can't even follow him, because I would have mentioned it, but there's just so much stuff that he did and so many lanes that he traveled that is easy to forget. And it's one thing, again, I'm not to criticize any of the coverage, but when everything is so Michael focused, it's like, man, Michael was huge, but that was just one of 100 things this man did.
Totally. I got to tell you a funny story, guys. Speaking of Quest Records, so in 81, Quincy Jones put out an album called The Dude, okay?
Yep.
And, it was essentially, like many of his records, it's a Quincy Jones album, but it has many, you know, guest artists on it, right? And it was, which I think was kind of fascinating. It was a way for him to showcase a lot of people he wanted to work with, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, two of the songs on there were hit songs sung by James Ingram, Just Once and 100 Ways, okay? And I got to tell you, this is a funny story from my life. I from time to time, play music trivia at this pub, and they'll have theme nights, and they'll do, every once in a while, they'll do 80s. And it's all like name that tune style. Like they'll play selections of songs and you identify the artist. You have identified the artist. And I got to tell you, I have whiffed more than once on those James Ingram songs because I put down James Ingram and they'll say, no, it's credited to Quincy Jones.
Right.
So I don't get credit for that.
I've been there.
Yeah.
Compliment what she does. Send her roses just because. If it's violin she loves, let them play. Dedicate her favorite song and hold her closer. Memory. If you need her so much more, why don't you say? Maybe she has it in her mind that she's just wasting her time. Ask her to stay.
It's funny you mentioned it, because like my favorite Quincy song is Secret Garden. And I know that's a Quincy song, but to me, that's a James Ingram, Barry White, Tell Me Your Secret. Like, that's that's the song. So I know it's Quincy's, but it's theirs. But Quincy gets the billing. I can't hate because I'm sure he put it together. So funny you mentioned that.
Tell me a secret. I don't just want to know about any secret of yours. I want to know about one special secret. Because tonight I want to learn all about the secrets in your garden.
I want to read your mind. I know your deepest feelings. I want to make it right for you. Baby, show a mystery.
Funny thing I learned back in the day, okay, so people are making a big deal out of the fact that Quincy Jones composed this song called Soul Bossa Nova.
Yeah.
1962.
Yep.
And it became, of course, it had sort of a big resurgence in the 90s with the Austin Powers movies because it was featured in like a big dance sequence or whatever in that, right? But I learned of that song a few years before because it was sampled by this group called the Dream Warriors. I don't know if you remember that, but I had to look up actually the title of the song. 1990, they had this song called My Definition of a Boombastic Jazz Style.
My Definition of a Boombastic Jazz Style. Is optimist. Fans are friends, I'm universal and cosmic. Concrete jungles abound. Stand by the speaker, you're smothered and covered up in the sound. You stand strong as you pump your fist. I'm talking all that jazz. Now what's my definition? My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. My definition is this. My definition. When I kick rhymes, it's often said to do damage. Skin so strong, even Superman needs a hand. So bob your head, dread, as I kick the funk flow. This rhyme
subliminal, yet you don't think so. I walk with a gold cane, a gold brain, and no gold chain. Behind the truth lies, there lies a paradox. In the mix is where dream warriors go. Define if you will, but I know so. There is no definition. My definition, my definition, my definition is this. My definition, my definition, my definition, my definition is this. My definition, my definition is this. My definition.
And it sampled that Soul Bossa Nova, and it was like one of those things where, like, the sample was so great, you know, like you hear the song and you're just like, oh my god, that just like jumps out of the speakers at you. It's so catchy and so cool. And then learn that, you know, and at that time learned that that was a Quincy Jones composition. Yep. And a sample, right? And then a few years later it becomes this big thing because of Austin Powers.
Yeah, that's right.
Ludacris jumped on that one too. It's weird how that became like the Austin Powers song.
Right.
But it had this legacy decades and decades before. But I mean, that's the magic of Quincy. He can have genius 50 years before something and it gets repackaged and revisited because it's that great. And then it continues to live on.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ed, about how it lives on and how it gets repackaged and put back out there for another generation or a new wave of musicians and artists to discover. Because when you look, he did a tremendous amount of work, but almost all of it you can find. You know, it's out there on the streamings. It's still available in physical copies in a lot of ways. And that's another statement, I think, to how important what he created was. You just think to yourself, how in the world did he never burn out like doing all these things? You know, it's like, how did he not have to take 2 years off and go live on an island and get away from everybody? It was just amazing. That was his life. It was so entwined with what he was doing that it kept him going, which I just find incredibly inspirational.
I think the fact that he was able to kind of twist and turn through TV and books and movies, and so he could still do the core of what he did, but also have that creative out, those creative avenues being a little bit different. That probably helped a lot. Yeah. And then, of course, he's mentored to dozens upon dozens of dozens. So I think that helped him, but being an insane workaholic did not hurt.
No, not so ever. And I think that's a great point with all those, his hands in those different areas, because, you know, if you were just a guitar player in a rock band or, you know, just a hip hop lyricist, you would face that burnout or hit that wall, I think, at some point.
And I don't know if people realize too, like, how hard arranging is. Like, that's a hard job. And that was like his first, you know, job that he did. That was where he sort of launched his career, was by doing jazz arrangements for like Lionel Hampton and Dizzy Gillespie and stuff like that, right? And I want to ask you, Patrick, too, as a jazz fan, you know, how do you view Quincy Jones in that arena?
Well, I think he's tremendously respected as a producer and arranger, and as somebody who, you know, could absolutely work in a lot of different styles if he needed to. I mean, at one point in the 70s, I think he tried to get Miles right before, or maybe it was even later than that, before Miles passed away, he tried to get Miles to come back and revisit some of those things he did with Gil Evans, you know, and kind of put a fresh spin on him and a new creation. So I think you've got to rank him, as far as a jazz producer and arranger, is high, just as high up there as anybody. But, you know, part of it too becomes that, like we were saying, it's not Quincy's name all the time. You know, it's a lot of, sometimes it's other people whose work you remember, or he's well remembered for producing some of those Ray Charles tracks, or he produced a tremendous album for Aretha Franklin too, that was in a lot different style than what she had done before. And I think it's great, but, you know, you tend to not think of him first in many occasions.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that Aretha album. That's another one I forgot about until someone shared it in our Facebook group a couple of days ago. And I remember the reaction of people being like, oh, this is so weird and different. But he always brought something new. And that's what I like. You never had a Quincy sound that everything sounds the same. Mm-hmm. I like that he pulls something new out of these artists.
That record is great. I pulled that out and listened to it this week, and it was really refreshing. I think it's aged wonderfully well.
Which album is that?
The Other Side of the Sky. That's okay. It, right?
That's it. Yep. That's it.
I got a call the other day. sister Carolyn saying, Aretha, come by when you can. I've got something that I want to say. And when I got there, she said, you know, rather than go through a long, drawn-out thing, I think the melody on the box will help me explain. Gotta find me an angel to fly away.
Any final thoughts, Ed?
Man, I could go for another 20 minutes, honestly, because there's so much to cover. But I think that Quincy's legacy is just pop culture in general, because we could talk about music, but then you're leaving out TV. Or if you're talking about TV, you're leaving out movies, and you're leaving out journalism. You're leaving out the humanitarian part. He touched so many aspects of our culture for decades upon decades, and I don't think there'll be another. I can't think of anyone who comes close. I've seen a few in our Facebook group. There was a debate about who would be the next one up, and folks were naming Raphael Sadiq. And they are great, but they didn't have nearly the wide-spreading touch that Quincy had. He is truly one of one, and it's okay that... That's why we call him legend. Some people cannot be topped. And I think that's what Quincy is. He's just this magnanimous figure that will never be taught, at least not in my generation or lifetime.
That's a great point.
Yeah,
well said. Very well said, yeah.
Okay, well, there's a lot of music out there, peoples, for you all to discover. There's a lot. So one of the great things about the legacy of somebody like this is that... You know, as we talked about, there's just so many layers. And so if you only know one aspect of this man, you can go and have a rich experience learning so much more. So, all right. Thank you very much, Ed.
Thanks, Ed. That was great.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Absolutely. We'll have you again under happier circumstances.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. And with that, it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And rest in power, Quincy Jones, and we'll talk to you all later.
I can't believe I'm here down at the Q's Juke Joint. The show is happening, y'all. But listening to this music kind of makes me think about when I used to listen to slow jams back in the day. Like Babyface Whip Appeal or R. Kelly Bump and Grind. But you know what? Sometimes when I'm just laying down with my man, I get the feeling I need to hear a little Barry White. Sure, you're right. Then there's other times when I just need a little section. What about some Teddy Pendergrass? Close the door and turn off the light.
This is Count Basie and Frank Sinatra. And you worked with both of these gentlemen. This is from 1964. And it's your arrangement of Fly Me to the Moon that Frank recorded, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they played it on the moon.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. With Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, oh, man. What is going on here? You guys just taking a, probably taking a smoke break, for God's sakes.
He said, he used to tell us every night, to Bates and I, guys, live every day like it's your last, and one day you'll be right.
No disputing that.